her name was. But he married me. She pushed back the sleeve of one of her cardigans, and there was the identification number. "You see?" she said. "I see," I said and nodded. I was crying, and Mrs. Levitt smiled and shrugged and patted my hand. "Everybody likes that story," she said. "But, you know, after that, then we were married. Everybody thinks because of the story it's like a fairy story. That's what one of Irving's nieces said once. Like a fairy story. I don't know. You got to live in the time you're living in. The past is the past, right, Irving?" "It's an amazing story," I said. "It's just a story," she said. "It's a long time ago now." "Are you going to bury him in the Veterans Cemetery, or Arlington in Washington?" Mrs. Levitt shook her head. "I already talked to the people at Perlman's. They'll cremate him. Then I can take him wherever I go." She looked over at the hospital bed. "You know what would have been the best thing for Irving? If he'd just gone home and married Sophie. She never married that girl. She taught fourth grade in the public schools until they made her retire. Irving would have married her and thought about me. And I would have married somebody else, or maybe not, and thought about Irving, how he saved me." She sighed. "Ach, well, I don't know what I'll do with myself now. Maybe I'll move down to Miami. Two of my friends from home live in Miami, both widows, Ruth and Esther, if you can believe it. I used to feel sorry for myself, tell people all my family was dead. They took them all away. My mama, my papa, my sister Rachel, my brothers. Now everyone I know is dead. They got old, they got sick, whatever." She lifted her hands to the sky. "Ah, what are you going to do?" At the door, I hugged her. "You look tired," she said. "My son had four of his buddies spend the night last night. They stayed up, you know. They were good, but you still don't sleep. You could have called me earlier." Mrs. Levitt smiled. "My sister and I, we did that. Rachel, she was the pretty one. I was smarter. Both of us in one big bed, the sheet over our heads, talking about the boys. You know, this and that. Our mama would yell at us, 'Go to sleep, go to sleep.'" She was smiling, Mrs. Levitt, but her eyes were full of tears. "Maybe your boy will want to take up golf," she finally said. "Maybe," I said. Just so you'll be ready, I need to warn you that Mrs. Burnson makes them all do family trees in fifth grade. Cindy handed me a cup of coffee. "Is she out of her tiny mind?" she said. It's exactly what I had told Mike Reardon when I picked Robert up, after he'd been held in after school because of what Mike called a verbal altercation with the despised Jonathan Green, who had said that the New York Yankees were a bunch of losers. "We've done some talking about keeping your temper and agreeing to disagree," Mike had said, handing over Robert's backpack, trying not to look at me or me at him, the horrible see and slide we'd both done with our eyes ever since we'd slept together. And Mike and I had had to agree to disagree about the genealogy lesson with which Mrs. Burnson proposed to galvanize the fifth grade during the waning weeks of the school year. A lesson that might have made sense when she'd started teaching 30 years before, but today was as perilous as walking down the center of Route 18. What would little Hillary Thompson, who stuttered like a jackhammer, do with her two stepfathers and their five collective children? What about Brittany MacLeod, who had been adopted from Paraguay and was as small and dark as her parents, now divorced, each remarried, were big and fair? She says that this always gives the class a lift, Mike said, shrugging. All I can tell you is every year I get complaints, and every year I hear afterward that it worked out fine. She's out of her mind, I said. There was no spring in Central Florida, just as there had been no real winter. No hiding the ungainly edges of its strip malls and ranch houses beneath the white hillocks of snow that lent charm to even the most charmless northeastern town in the months that seemed to stretch endlessly between Christmas and Easter. Or, as Mrs. Levitt informed me when I complained about the lack of seasons, between Hanukkah and Pesach. The change of seasons might touch the tired foliage in the farm fields and the shades of green on the development lawns, but on the narrow streets with their yards of yellow-white gravel and their struggling shrubs where I lived and worked, the seasons were visible only in the displays in the store windows, the green of Christmas giving way to the red of Valentine's Day and the purple of Easter and now the pink of Mother's Day. Robert walked to the strip and bought me a box of candy and a stuffed bear holding a balloon that said, I love you. Cindy made lasagna, but Mrs. Manford couldn't come, had stomach flu or some such. Thank God it didn't happen the day after, or my dad would have sworn it was my cooking, Cindy said. The next day, Robert had no school, some teacher's conference or another, and he went with me to visit Mrs. Levitt. The television was on, as it always was, and the noon news featured a story about a police shootout in the Bronx. 4 officers dead and 2 wounded, the greatest carnage in 20 years for the New York City Police Department. As though still corded together, my boy and I sank down side by side on the sofa and leaned toward the television as though, face to face, it could tell us more than the sketchy story a woman in a bright red suit and matching lipstick was reading from a teleprompter. We didn't have cable in our apartment, couldn't afford it, but the Castros did, and Robert knew to flip to other news channels. For an hour we waited, watched, as though we were those people I'd seen so often in the public areas of the hospital, mouths agape, half asleep in molded chairs, waiting for the doctor to bring them news. Finally, there were names, and we sank back, exhausted. I put my arm around his shoulder. You know people who are police officers in New York? Mrs. Levitt said softly, placing another cup of tea in front of me. Family, maybe? And Robert looked into my face with fear and yearning, too, and I squeezed his shoulder. We have friends in the department, I said. None of them were hurt. I'm glad Daddy's not dead, Robert said as we began walking home. Me too, I said, really. I'm really happy that he's okay. Is he okay? Robert said. Do you know he's okay? You heard the news. But I mean really okay, like every day. I hope so, I said. How many times had I wished Bobby would die? I lost count years ago. It was my biggest fear when he was first a street cop that the phone would ring, that the chaplain would come to the door, that I would have to hear those bagpipes again that I'd heard wailing at his father's funeral. That all I'd have left was a piss-poor pension and his badge in the bottom of my jewelry box. Even on those days when he'd first twisted my arm or shoved me into the wall, I still woke and peered at the digital clock and then lay back to wait if he was even a half hour behind his usual time. I'd be awake when he dropped his clothes in the corner, the belt buckle making a ka-chunk in the quiet house. When he slipped between the sheets, smelling of scotch and beer, tasting of it, too, as he put his arms around me and eased my nightgown up, hand over hand, like he was climbing a rope up into me. And then there were the nights when I began to dread the sound of the door opening softly downstairs, 2 or 3 hours past the time he got off. the sound of his stumble on the stairs, or the loud bangings of cabinet and refrigerator door from the kitchen, semaphore for discontent. An investigation going nowhere, a witness who'd been arrogant or uncooperative, even a car nosed a little too far toward the entrance to our driveway. The nights when he would pick a fight, throw open the bedroom door to say, "Where the hell is the bread?" or ignore the regular breathing I learned to fake, and come over me, into me, no matter what. God forgive me, but there were so many times he went out to work, and I would think the best thing that could happen to me was the call. The chaplain, the casket with the handsome cop I'd married inside it, who would never, ever be able to lay a hand on me again, a fist in my face or rough fingers that opened me up as though I was a tunnel through which he was entitled, as a matter of right, to pass. When I was thinking about it rationally, I knew it was no solution. That for my son, his father would become a martyr, a man he would idolize and about whom he could never be told, never stand to hear the truth, the whole truth, nothing but. But often I was not thinking rationally, and I wished with all my heart that some low-life's bullet would find a soft spot on Bobby's body. One of the soft spots I had lost the ability to find myself, with my hands or my tears or my words. "Why did you say Daddy was a friend?" Robert said a week later out of nowhere as he was working on his family tree. "That day when you were talking to Mrs. Levitt? When the other police got hurt?" "Well, he sort of is," I said. But that was never true. Every time I saw a woman describe her husband as her best friend in some magazine or another, I always wondered what in the world she was talking about. Bobby and I had never been friends, ever, or I could never have loved him so completely and let him treat me so badly. Hunched over a sheet of gleaming poster paper, Robert began to sketch out his family tree for Mrs. Burnson. And as he did, I thought of how little he asked about the past and the future. Any other child would have been at me constantly with questions about when and whether we were going back. Any other child would have slipped up at school, told his friends where he was really from, boasted that his father was a policeman, pointed to the map of Italy during social studies and made a lie of the nondescript Middle American last name that he carried. But as I watched Robert spread his left arm wide around his work as though to hide or shelter it, I realized that he had been in training for this subterfuge almost his whole life, learning to ignore what was in the next room, to hide what he knew from others, to refrain from asking the wrong questions. His parents had always been in disguise. It was just a different disguise now. A different sort of false mustache, funny hat. "Do you want help?" I asked nervously from the kitchen. "Not yet," he said. I made some macaroni and read a magazine and the new Avon catalog, and there was still no sound from the room. Then he appeared in the doorway, smiling, nodding his head, taking my hand and pulling me to the card table. "I figured out how to do this," he said. "Like, once I don't mind what I call people, then it can be just like it really is. Here's Daddy, only I call him Robert Crenshaw. And here's Daddy's Daddy, and I called him the same thing. It's just the same, only with different names." And so it was. As I filled him in on the generations that had gone before, I made amendments, but few were necessary. There was one telltale Giuseppe, Robert's paternal great-grandfather, but I named him Joe. My mother-in-law's maiden name was Stanowitz. I let her keep it. "And mine?" "Pick one," I told Robert, making a game of it. "Give me a name before I was married." He made it Wynne. Elizabeth Wynne. It sounded sort of grand. "What about Grandmom?" he asked. And my mother went in true to life, O'Donnell as she'd been born and raised, too far out on a limb to shatter the disguise of our new existence. "See, I know who they are," Robert said. That's enough, right? That I know. Like, everybody in the class will be looking, and it will say Robert Crenshaw, and I'll know what it's supposed to really be.
That's right, I said.
I know. Like, remember how Daddy took me that one time to the place where he was working in Central Park? There was this big policeman there, I can't remember his name, but he was really, really big.
McMichael. Captain McMichael, he was the station commander there.
That was him, I think. And he kept looking at me and saying, "You're not a Benedetto. I know you're not. I knew your grandfather, and I know your father. Nah, I can tell, you're not a Benedetto." And I think he was saying it like a joke, because I looked like Daddy. But I was only a little kid, like 5, and I didn't really understand that it was a joke. I thought maybe he was right, that I was adopted or something, like that Korean kid in my old school who was always telling everybody he was Italian just because his name was Russo, and everybody thought he was really stupid. And Daddy could kind of tell that I was upset, and when we went out to get ice cream from the Good Humor truck in the park, we were sitting on this bench, and he said to me, "See this?" And he pointed to that really big vein in my arm. He held it out, thin and bony, and pointed to the blue artery that ran behind the elbow, his grubby finger outlining it for me. And then Daddy showed me the one he had. It was really big, and it kind of bulged out. And he said, "There's a part of me in you, and there's a part of you in me. And there's a part of me in all the kids you'll have, and their kids."
"That's true," I said.
"I know,"
he said, picking up his pencil again and coloring in some leaves. Then he asked casually, as though he was only wondering whether he should use a forest green or a medium green pencil,
"Remember that time that Daddy busted Nana's mirror in the hall, and then he said he was really, really sorry and got her another one? If he did that to you, would you say it was all right?"
"I don't know," I said.
"I don't mean like go back,"
he said, not looking up from the paper.
"I mean like accept his apology."
"I don't know, sweetie," I said. "A lot of bad things happened with Daddy and me. He did a lot of things to me that he shouldn't have. He shouldn't have hit me, ever. No one should ever hit another person. And he did, a lot. I know it's a hard thing to understand why he did what he did. I don't even understand it. Maybe someday I will."
"I need to finish this,"
Robert said, his pencil point coming down hard on the poster paper. "Sometimes I felt as if I'd spent my life sitting on the closed lid of the toilet seat with the water running while I cried. And I wondered whether Robert, sitting downstairs working away on his project, heard the sound of the cold water tap at full throttle as somehow soothing, the background noise of his childhood nights as familiar as the rumble of the furnace coming on." It took me a long time to finish this time, to throw cold water on my wan face, to blow my nose, and then use a little concealer to veil the flush of emotion. Then I folded laundry and changed sheets. Cotton had always helped me get over the humps. By the time I went back downstairs, the names were all neatly printed, and Robert was working on his tree, a mighty oak by the look of it, many-branched, thick-trunked, sketched in with colored pencils. And as I admired it, exclaiming over his neatness and the careful attention to the leaves, I realized I would have to tell Mike that Mrs. Burnson was wiser than I, at least in this case. For there was Robert. Just Robert, I noticed, with no surname at all. At the bottom of the trunk, at the roots, the base, the center of it all. He had not colored the leaves in yet, and the trunk and its branches looked for the moment less like a tree and more like a great brown river. The Nile, the Amazon, the Benedetto and Flynn River of Blood. And there, at its isthmus, was this one child, so that it seemed that all of these people, from Poland, from Italy, from Ireland and the Bronx and Brooklyn, had come together for no other reason than to someday produce Robert Benedetto. In an event as meant, as important as that one in Bethlehem that he had learned about in catechism class at St. Stanny's. There was Robert, the reason for the collision of these incongruous constellations, the savior of us all. "Is it all right?" he said. "It's beautiful. It's perfect. I'm really, really proud of you." He had been proud of himself, too, I could tell. He'd rolled the poster paper carefully, tying it at each end with a bit of twine, and he'd carried it out to the bus in both hands. The way he stood with it reminded me of when he was 4, in blue satin shorts and a white satin tuxedo shirt, the ring-bearer at the wedding of one of Anne Benedetto's godchildren. It reminded me of the way, his face solemn, he'd carried the blue satin pillow, held close to his narrow chest, down the long aisle of the church. Benny was the same, the way he carried his. It was as though they had their lives in their hands, these beautiful, dark-faced, displaced boys. The look of them, so serious, so proud somehow, stayed with me all day, while I scolded the dialysis patient for eating too much junk and shopped for the woman with cerebral palsy. "Hi," I said casually when Robert came back home that afternoon, letting a great cloud of warm air into the dim air-conditioned cool of the apartment. There was a laundry basket on the couch, and I was folding more sheets, matching corners, my arms spread in a kind of benediction, so I did not immediately see his face. And when I did, I couldn't at first believe it, couldn't take it in. I stood holding the sheet across myself like a curtain, my eyes and mouth wide above it, a cartoon woman. "My God," I said, and pulled him into the light from the window. It looked worse than it was. His upper lip was swollen on one side, purple and misshapen, and the area just below his left eye was beginning to color. There was a ribbon of blood beneath his mouth, but I discovered as I used my own spit to remove it, not taking the time for towel or water, that there was no wound beneath it. Maybe the gum had bled and had stopped bleeding. "What happened?" I said. "Jonathan Green is a jerk-off," he said, and his voice quavered deep in his throat like a bird call. "Sit down," I said. Ice, aspirin, tissues. I put them on the flimsy coffee table and put my arm around him. A shudder ran through him, and then he looked up, his fingers going to his lip. The colored pencils were still spread out on the kitchen table, a rainbow lying awry. "Wait," he said, and went upstairs into the bathroom. I knew he was looking at himself in the mirror. "This wasn't my fault," he said. "I pushed him first, but he deserved it. He's had it coming all year. He's a jerk, the biggest jerk in the school. I hope I broke his nose." "He called Benny a spick. You know what a spick is?" I nodded. "We were talking in class about where we were from, and he started it. He was starting to talk about how you shouldn't be allowed to live here unless you could speak English. He was saying that America was too small for Americans and all these other people were coming here and taking stuff away. He goes like, 'Oh, they can't even speak English.' And Goalie was really embarrassed, I could tell. And this girl named Christy, you don't know her, but her parents are Greek or something, and they can't speak English that good, I don't think. And I said there were lots of people who couldn't speak that good English but were nice people."
"Didn't Mrs. Burnson say anything?"
"She said I was right. She said her parents were German and it took them a long time to learn English, and now look at her, she taught English. But then we got dismissed for the day, and we got outside, and Jonathan comes up with Benny right there, and he says, 'I only said what I said because of my spick friend.' That's what he said, 'Your spick friend.' I just shoved into him as hard as I could. He called Benny a spick. Then he hit me. Then I hit him. Blood was beating up on his lower lip again, and I handed him a tissue. He pressed it to his mouth hard.
I sat on him and made him take it back, he finally said.
His words were muffled by his lip, which was getting bigger. Put some ice on that, I said. He slumped down in the sofa, his back bent, his elbows on his knees, avoiding my eyes. There were lemon popsicles in the freezer, and I gave him one, two birds with one stone, the ice and the unexpected before-dinner treat. Jonathan is a jerk, I said. He's been goading you from day one, and he's got a mean mouth on him. So now you know that he's mean down to the ground. Now you know that the only way to deal with Jonathan is to stay away from him. You're going to meet people like him your whole life. They're ignorant and spiteful, and they call names because they figure it makes them big if they can make someone else small. Makes them high if they can make someone else low. Benny is such a star. Everyone likes him, and he's so good at sports and school that Jonathan had to pull him down. So he calls him a spick. So it tells you more about Jonathan than it does about Benny.
I said that, Robert said. I said he didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't even know what a spick was. I knew from Daddy. Daddy talked about spicks with Mr. Hogan and Mr. Carter. He said the spicks live like animals and that they killed that policeman in Washington Heights. The one that Daddy helped train when you went to the funeral. The spicks killed him.
I winced. Don't use that word, Ba, I said. Spick is a word that people use to talk about people who are Spanish. Puerto Ricans, Cubans like Benny. They're Latino, but people who don't like them call them spicks.
That's not what Daddy said. Daddy said the spicks messed up the city.
Maybe you didn't hear him right, I said, hearing the whole rant in my head the way I'd heard it a dozen times. They breed like rabbits. They won't learn the language. They put their women to work filling nickel bags. The girls dress like whores. The boys can't keep their pants on. Why the hell don't they stay where they belong? They were like the words to a song that I'd heard so many times I scarcely noticed it anymore. The words all blurred together.
I thought spicks were bad guys, like robbers or guys who sold drugs.
No, I said.
So what are they?
Spick is a word that some people use to describe people who come from Spanish-speaking countries. The way people who don't like black people call them niggers.
So when Daddy was talking about spicks, he was talking about Puerto Rican people and Cuban people?
Bah, I said. And then when I saw his face twist, Robert. Sometimes police officers get very frustrated with all the bad stuff they see around them. They want to say bad things about bad guys, and sometimes they use words they shouldn't use. Your daddy would tell you that if he was here. Robert sucked on his popsicle and stared into the middle distance, one eye beginning to close up into a shining slit, his other focused on nothing. For a long time we sat there, side by side, not touching. Finally, he stood wearily, like an old man, sore and tired. I'm going up to do my homework, he said.
Bah, I said, it's all right. I don't really like to be called that anymore, he said.
15 minutes later, the bell rang, and Benny was at the door. I could see tear streaks on his face. He was carrying a comic book. Don't punish him, he said when I told him Robert was up in his room. I fried chicken, boiled rice, wondered how we would talk to each other at dinner. But when I went upstairs to call Robert, he was asleep on his bed, his face turned to the window, soft and bruised like overripe fruit, a sweet peach, a golden plum. I left everything on the stove to keep warm. I had to say this for Bobby. Just like the other horrid things he never did that one in front of the child, at least knowingly. He'd kept nigger out of the conversation, and whore, and all the rest, or at least he thought he had. but so much had taken place just within the range of Robert's peripheral vision, things I might never really know, things he might never admit to himself, things that made him what he was today, sleeping upstairs in his clothes, twitching slightly. He slept through his favorite television program and Benny stopping by again with a video game and another comic. There was a glossy moon, cut from the silver paper of early summer, outside the bathroom window as I got ready for bed, and its light shone across Robert's bed and spilled onto the floor of his room, where his school books, covered in brown paper covered with doodles, lay in a motley pile. I stacked them on the floor next to his bed, but he never stirred. My own sleep was like clouds scudding across the sky, the white numbers on the digital clock looming out of the dark as I raised my head. 12:27, 1:12, 2:14. There was the sound of a siren someplace outside, wailing and then waning. And then I heard the sound of voices from downstairs. Underneath my bed was the crowbar I'd taken so long ago from Mr. Castro, and I closed my fingers around it and slid out of my room, down the hall, and down the stairs. "I know," I heard a voice say, and I realized it was Robert's. He was in the kitchen, and when I reached the bottom of the stairs, I could see through the door that he was on the telephone. He was sitting cross-legged in the clothes he'd slept in, his back against the refrigerator. In the moonlight, I could see a stack of Oreo cookies on the floor, like the pieces to a game, checkers maybe, or gambling chips. "I know," he said again. "I want to, too." The silence seemed to vibrate. The crowbar felt heavy in my hand, and I wanted to put it down. "Then why did you?" Robert said. And then, "I am. I'm playing soccer and basketball and baseball. I play third base. I'm getting pretty good." He rubbed his eyes, winced when he touched the bruises by mistake, pulled an Oreo apart and licked the cream. "I watched it too," he said. "I knew you were watching it." I should have moved sooner, but it was only then that I was sure. I stepped out of the blackness in my white nightgown, and Robert dropped the receiver, staring at my face and then at the crowbar in my hand. The receiver bounced on its long cord 3 times gently against the wall, and then I picked it up with 2 fingers and dropped it into the cradle. But not before I heard his voice on the other end, deep and sleepy. "Robert? Hey? Robert?" "Put the cookies back," I said. "You lied to me," he said, rising to his feet, his eyes only a little lower than my own. "About what?" I said. "About a bunch of things." "I didn't lie about anything, Robert. You did something really, really foolish tonight, and if you ever do it again, we'll have to move and start over someplace else. No Benny, no Cindy, new school, new friends." "I want to see my dad," Robert said. "You lied to me about him." "About what?" "About a lot of things. He said you lied about a lot of things."
"Tell me what he said."
"No, you'll just say bad things about him. He loves me. He misses me."
"I know that. I never denied that."
"He loves you too," he said.
"Did you tell him where we were?"
"No,"
Robert said, his voice cracking. "Did he ask you?" He nodded. "And what did you say?"
"I told him I wasn't allowed. He said he never meant that about the Spics, that he had a friend in narcotics who's Puerto Rican. He said it was good that I stood up for my friend. He said sometimes you have to do that."
"He said, he said, he said." It was like having him there in the room all over again as the words came at me, the old familiar justifications and accusations, all in Robert's voice, still high and light. "Bah," I said, then stopped. "I didn't lie to you about anything."
I touched his face. Do you remember when my face looked like this? Only worse? My nose broke? I'm lucky my jaw was okay. His tears shook him so that he bounced in my arms almost the way I had bounced him as a baby, trying to lull him to sleep. The front of my nightgown was wet. There was a little blood mixed with the tears.
I didn't tell,
he finally said. I know, honey.
I wanted to ask about the Spick thing,
he said. I know. I left the crowbar by the hall closet, and together we climbed the stairs. An hour later, when I was certain he was asleep again, I went downstairs and pulled a business card from behind his baby picture in my wallet. It was an answering machine, I knew, and after the beep I said, "This is Elizabeth Crenshaw. I need to speak to Patty Bancroft immediately. She has my number." After he'd left on the bus in the morning, more than a little proud of his rattled face, Benny's arm around his shoulder, I walked over to the school. Mike Reardon was at his desk when I tapped at the door. When he saw me, he looked the way I must look when Robert opens the door at the end of the day. It made me hate myself, that look. Such happiness, such shame-faced yearning. To cover up, he lobbed a wad of loose leaf into the toy basketball hoop stuck to the wall next to his desk with suction cups. There was a poster next to it of a cat trying to hold onto a high bar. "Hang in there, baby," it said underneath. We'd had it in the nurse's lounge at South Bay, too. "I need help," I said, and I sat in the straight chair on the other side of his desk. "Okay," he said. "To begin with," I said, "my name is Francis Benedetto, and I'm from New York City." It was 9:10 when I started, and 9:30 by the time I was done. How short a time it took to tell him everything, to feel the secret fall from my shoulders like a yoke. He drove me to Cindy's house the first Saturday after school let out, half a dozen foil containers filled with food slithering from side to side on the back seat. "Don't take those corners so wide," I said, "or you're going to have barbecued riblets and chicken wings all over the car." He frowned slightly into the sunlight and took his foot off the gas until his little car was going maybe 10 miles an hour and an elderly woman had edged around him and then pulled in front. "Ha, ha, ha," I said. I'd been cooking for 2 days, and I'd had to smack the boys with a dish towel on their skinny dark brown legs as they filched potato pancakes and mahogany-colored riblets. "You're a good cook, Mrs. Crenshaw," Benny said politely. "Don't try to get around me with sweet talk," I said. Robert only smiled. The marks on his face were gone, and maybe it was only my imagination that he seemed quieter. He'd always been so quiet anyhow. "I understand him so much better now," Mike Reardon said to me after I told him our story. "Thanks. It makes it easier for me." It had made it easier for me, too. The notion that the man had seen me naked, had put his tongue into my mouth, had unbuttoned my dress, none of it meant anything compared to the fact that he knew where I really came from, what my name was, what I really did for a living, what my son had had to live through. Even his smile seemed to have knowledge in it, and understanding, and it had made me feel more myself and less afraid with him than with anyone else, even Cindy. That day when I came to talk to him, he had leaned forward, asking no questions, looking me straight in the eye. And when I was finished, he had come around the desk and sat in the chair the dads usually sat in when Mike was having parent conferences. He had taken my hand, and he had rubbed my fingers hard, as though they were cold, and he was trying to bring back the blood into them. "You're amazing," was all he said. He looked over at me in the car, speeding up and smiling now. "Robert's fine," he said, reading my mind. "I know." "No, you don't. But I do. He's a smart kid. He'll work all this out. But I do know. I know it's not true. Children are resilient, some of the shrinks like to say. And everything marks them, say some of the others. And both things are true. Sometimes it seems as if Robert never called Bobby on the phone that night, never took his side over mine. Sometimes it seems as if Mike Reardon and I are no more than a boy's coach and a boy's mother, as though I never chose him over Robert. But Robert has scars as surely as I do, and his are more dangerous because he cannot see them and so can believe they are not there.
You think too much, Fran, Bobby told me once when I was analyzing this or that. And he was right. I guess I do.
What I'm thinking is that I can hardly hear his voice anymore. Bobby's voice, that ruled my life, that made me jerk like I was at the end of a leash. Even on the phone, it had sounded like the voice of someone I'd once known a while ago.
You think too much, Fran.
I can't quite hear him say it.
He was right about that. I do think too much.
If you're a good nurse, you always do think too much, see too much, know too much. You look at the cleaned-up junkie with pneumonia who's telling you it's just a cold, man, a little vitamin C and some sleep and I'll be good as new. And you know, practically without double-gloving and drawing the blood, that he's slipped over the border from being HIV positive to having AIDS and is skidding toward the finish line of death. You see a little kid come into the waiting room with her mother. See the child do a slow and subtle lean back when the mother turns toward her. And you know, you just know, that the mother hits her. The X-rays will only tell you how hard. Winnie used to say that she knew what some of them would tell her before they even opened their mouths, from the set of their shoulders, the slant of their gaze. She used to say that it was like being a priest sometimes. I felt the same way. I call Grace now, and I know that something is wrong. Suddenly there is an answering machine on her home phone. The message is curt, anonymous. Please leave a message after the beep. 3 times I've said, Gracie, it's me. But I'm afraid to give her the number here, afraid of who else might hear it, see it written by the phone on a scrap of paper. 2 I called her office, but it is the same thing there, the recorded voice, the hunk at the end. We're good, I said the last time. We're fine. She's not. I can hear it in the cold timbre of her recorded voice. The cold in her makes cold in me. That, and Robert's phone call, and the television news program after the carnival, and what I know about Bobby, how good he is at finding out what he wants to know. I look at the hump growing larger between Mrs. Levitt's perpetually slumped shoulders, and I pretty much know that if she takes the slightest tumble 2 or 3 years from now, it'll be a broken hip and a nursing home, a walker if not a wheelchair. Take your calcium pills, I say, banging the plastic bottle on the tiny kitchen counter. Ugh, they bind me up, she says, eating Chips Ahoy. I bring another kind of calcium, one that doesn't cause constipation. You need to build up your bones, I remind her, and she looks at me pityingly, as though to say, Mrs. Nurse, what do you think happened to my bones those 4 years they fed me mealy grain and dirty water and did whatever it was to my insides that meant I would never have a child? I see Mrs. Levitt now always in terms of her great secret. The numbers on her arm, the story of her marriage. And I realize that everyone has, her whole life, ever since that May Day 50 years ago. I hid my wounds because I was ashamed, ashamed of Bobby and ashamed of myself for staying with him. But now I know that I was also afraid of being reduced, of becoming in the minds of all who knew me that poor woman whose husband beats her, or used to. I have begun to think of myself as someone who used to get beat up by her husband. I am a recovering, battered woman. God, I hate that term. All those classifications that seem to reduce our wounds to the same status as eye or hair color, that make us a type, a cover line in a magazine. The Holocaust survivors, Mrs. Levitt said savagely one day when she saw a story on the news. Like a club, people have no shame. I see, and I know. I know by the dandelion yellow of my patient Melvin's skin that if he doesn't get a kidney transplant in the next 90 days, I will be attending his funeral instead of taking his temperature. I know that my cerebral palsy patient is lonely for love and romance because of the name she uses when she goes into chat rooms on the computer, Sexy Jen. I wonder how she describes herself when she is no more than a line of black letters on someone else's screen. Wonder if she makes herself tall and lithe, with muscles that run smooth beneath the surface of tan skin, instead of arms and legs that shiver and shake in an uncontrollable dance. She wants to be someone else, somewhere else, and I can't blame her. I know that Mike Reardon has decided to try to make things right by making them lighter. Robert plays baseball now, just like he told his dad, and Mike takes us out from time to time afterward. Benny usually comes along, and Robert measures the distance between his coach and his mother with his eyes. It is considerable. The week after we'd gone to bed together, I had bought myself some contraceptive sponges, but I'd done it the way you buy aspirin in case some Saturday night you have a headache. Things are back to where they were. No more flaming steak or tuxedoed head waiters. Still, whenever Mike brings us home, if it happens that Robert goes down the pavement to Benny's or upstairs to start his homework, Mike steps inside the apartment, puts his arms around me and kisses me, less gently than he had that first time. Once, when we met in the Rohrbacher's basement during a school swim party, he coming out of the concrete shower stall in his shorts, his hair wet and raked back with the marks of Craig's comb still in it, me in the blue tank suit Cindy lent me, smelling of coconut from the sunscreen. He had reached for me, held me for a long time, finally pushed back, groaning. "I'm a patient person," he said. "You're being cruel to that poor man," Cindy had said next day as we watched the kids swim. I don't mean to be. He'd be better off if I stayed out of his way, but that's hard under the circumstances. I like him, Cindy said. I like him too. Then what's your problem? I like you too. And honey, I'd have you in a minute if we were so inclined, but we're not. How come all of us are attracted to girlfriends who are nice and smart and helpful and love us, and we're all attracted to guys who are mean and give us a hard time? Craig's not mean. Craig's different. So's Mike Reardon, which is the point I'm trying to make. You want to try this new scented insect repellent we're coming out with?
What's it smell like?
Cindy sniffed. Musk.
No thanks.
Plus, he loves kids, Cindy had said. I knew when Cindy got pregnant, almost before she did. Her hair went limp, and one day, in the library, as we sent out overdue cards, she snapped at Mrs. Petrinian, "We know what we're doing here." Mrs. Petrinian turned red, and so I think did I. In April, she started drinking herb tea in the morning instead of coffee, and when we all had burgers and beer out back, she drank soda water. The buttons on her white blouse, the sleeveless one, bulged a bit, showing a patch of skin between her breasts. For some reason, she didn't tell me right away. There were long pauses in our conversation, and she was dying to fill them with this, the most exciting news that any woman ever has, or sometimes the worst. My son misses his father, I had said to Mrs. Levitt, taking her blood pressure as she ate a frozen yogurt with her free hand. After Mr. Levitt died, her doctor had given her a physical and pronounced her hypertense, overweight. The diagnosis had enabled him to continue sending me to the Levitt apartment. Nothing has changed there except that the hospital bed is gone, and Mrs. Levitt keeps the door to the terrace open, although the freshening warm breezes of a Florida spring will soon blow hot. "The air should come in," she had said the first time I noticed the sliding glass doors ajar. "You smell a little cold in the morning. You know it'll be a nice day. Too cold, with that hard-feeling snow. At least in Chicago, you need the fresh air." Irving is in a stainless steel jar on an occasional table. It rattles if you shake it. Robert once asked what it was. "Ah, a knick-knack thing," Mrs. Levitt had said, rolling her eyes at me. "It is hard for the children," she added quietly, licking a vanilla mustache from her upper lip. "Life is not easy." "I feel foolish complaining to you of all people."
"Why?" "Your life."
Mrs. Levitt shrugged. "You shouldn't have told me it was yogurt," she said, looking at her cone. "I would have thought it was ice cream." She licked, then said, "The big things, eh? It's all the other things. Like now, whether to keep the cable, to move, what to do between breakfast and lunch." "You're lonely," I said.
"No, no," Mrs. Levitt said. "Filling the hours when you're an old lady, it's not a feeling, just a job. Sometimes now I still talk to Irving. I'm entitled."
"I still shouldn't complain."
"You call that complaining?
You don't know complaining. Anyway, other people's troubles don't take away yours.
But don't be foolish and think somebody else is having everything fine."
Of course, that was exactly what I had always thought. As a child walking home in my school uniform past the homes where it seemed reading lights shone yellow from the window to illuminate the evening hours of handsome and lively fathers, warm and sympathetic mothers, children who were tucked in tight beneath their blankets each night in rooms bright with wallpaper. There were even times as an adult when I had thought it of myself, of Bobby and Robert and me, eating beneath the brass chandelier in the small dining room, the dishes and glasses shining as though they'd been given to us as prizes, the flowered plates, plaques to commemorate our love for one another. If it would all stay like this moment, I would think to myself. And then, as we cleared the table, stacked the dishes, darkened the house for the night, the feeling would be gone, as bright and ephemeral as the lamplight. "Things will happen to a boy that you cannot help," Mrs. Levitt added. "You sound like a fortune teller."
"Just so. They always say these things that you can say about anyone. Life will be good and bad. You will meet people who can help you. Someone you love will die. Big deal."
"Did you take your calcium?" She held out her cone.
"Better than pills," she said. "Even better if it was chocolate. They make chocolate yogurt?"
"Cindy eats frozen yogurt now, drinks milk, stops at the farm stand every day for fresh vegetables. I remember doing the same not long ago."
"A year ago." "Only a year." "A year ago I had a secret inside me, and just like Cindy, I kept it a secret. Even Bobby didn't know I was pregnant. Even Grace. A good nurse would have known. Winnie had cocked her head on the side one afternoon when we were slow in the emergency room, put her hands on her big hips, screwed up a corner of her mouth. "How are you feeling?" she said.
"The way a woman walks, flat-footed, her toes turned out a little, her pelvis thrust forward as though her body's proud of itself. A good nurse knows." I knew everything when I went to the clinic 2 days after Bobby broke my nose that last time.
I lay on the table with the sheet over my knees and saw the bottle and the hose in the corner, and knew exactly how they would use it. They were kind at the clinic. "Let me tell you about the procedure," said the counselor, who kept looking at my battered face, at the bandages and the telltale perimeter of black and blue and red. "I'm a nurse," I said. "I know." When I'd assisted at abortions myself, I'd told the patient there would be some cramping. Now I know that wasn't exactly true. It hurt. I was glad it hurt. The more it hurt, the more I knew I had the guts to get up from the table and leave Bobby Benedetto. I wanted to know whether it was a boy or a girl, but I didn't ask. And it wouldn't really have made a difference. A boy to learn that a man can keep a woman in line with the flat of his hand. A girl to learn that men love you and hurt you in equal measure. None of the above, I kept thinking. None of the above. One of those pieces of nonsense that gets stuck somewhere between your mind and your mouth when you're having a hard time. The machine made a noise like the window air conditioner in our bedroom. I stared at the ceiling, my eyes dry and gritty. They gave us Lorna Doones and apple juice in the recovery room. "You'll get your girl," Bobby had said after my miscarriages. But he was wrong. "We're done here," the doctor said. Maybe that's what I felt when Mike Reardon came inside me. Not Bobby, but the doctor. The speculum. I'd lain on the table and fiddled with the adhesive tape that pulled when I moved my mouth. "What happened to your face?" the doctor said. "I was in a car accident," I said. I don't think about it very much anymore. What it felt like on the subway as I went from the clinic on the east side of Manhattan home to Brooklyn to make Robert a snack after school. That night I fell asleep planning my escape and had a dream. I was running on the Coney Island boardwalk and I saw a little girl in a lime green ruffled bathing suit struggling in the waves. I ran to the edge of the ocean, but two police officers were already there. "We'll handle this, ma'am," one of them said, and smiled at me. I turned around and started running again without looking back. It was quiet in my dream. There was no sound of the child or the policeman splashing through the water. She'd be 6 months old now. She'd be sitting up and babbling and laughing at her big brother's funny faces. I can't think about that too much. It's the worst thing that Bobby did to me, or that I did to myself because of him. But I can think about it more now than I could before, when I just let my mind drop a curtain over it. And I couldn't stop thinking about it in the car on the way to Cindy's baby shower. I couldn't stop thinking about it all day long. I thought about it as Mike and I brought the food in through the cellar door, Craig meeting us, Chelsea behind him hauling Chad around like a sack of grain, limp and pale. "Let me down," he shouted, but Chelsea paid him no mind. "I put so much soda on ice I had to use a second tub for it," Craig said. "The cake came, and I put it in the fridge, but it takes up all the room in there."
"It has a sugar umbrella on it," Chelsea said. "Can I have it after?"
"Absolutely," I said.
"Where's Robert?"
"He went on a camping trip with Mr. Castro and Benny, down to the Hidden Forest Game Preserve. Benny's dad said they might see alligators."
"I don't like alligators," said Chelsea.
"Me neither."
"Hi, Mr. Reardon,"
Chelsea added. I let Chelsea have what she wanted that day. The umbrella made her sick, what with the ribs and three cans of Coke, but I let her have it anyway, even though it was pure spun sugar. We ate nearly all the food I'd made.
The PTA mothers, two high school friends from Lakota, Mrs. Manford and two of her sisters, Cindy's aunts. Cindy had been out shopping with her mother, and when she came in and saw the pile of boxes and the white lace umbrella hanging over the recliner in her den, I knew she'd kill me if we used the living room and spilled anything on the top carpet. She'd screamed and covered her face.
"I'm gonna kill you for this, Beth, I swear I am," she said.
But I just smiled, and smiled some more, seeing her round and flushed, with the big hard swell of her belly beneath her flared white blouse. The maternity clothes, a big improvement from the time when I was pregnant with Robert almost 13 years before, when everything had had lace and ribbons and flowers, as though to have a baby you had to look like one. 5 months gone she was, but she looked more because she was carrying twins. The sonogram said it was a boy and a girl, and she'd kept her pregnancy a secret for almost 3 months because the doctor wasn't sure if they were going to make it.
"I could have lost them both," she told me finally.
And I thought of my lost child and then put the thought aside in the face of her happiness. She loved things to be special, Cindy, and twins are special. The boxes spilled forth duplicate treasures, two pairs of tiny denim overalls, two receiving blankets in soft flannel, two embroidered samplers, one pink, one blue, two teddy bears, one in a bow tie and top hat, the other in a dress.
"Oh, I love these,"
Chelsea moaned, as Chad wadded up the wrapping paper and applauded every new gift. I went into Cindy's kitchen to refill the serving dishes she'd gotten as wedding presents, probably at a shower much like this one. I remembered going to Bermuda for a week with Buddy and Marie not long after I was married, and standing in the airport looking at the cities on the departure board, and thinking that I could take the traveler's checks and just go anywhere. Seattle, Cincinnati, Paris, Grand Rapids, Montego Bay, and start a whole new life. I don't know why I thought it at that moment. Bobby and I were still in love then. Maybe everybody thinks it at some time or another, just thinks about becoming another person. Giving up the law for a life as a golf pro, trading teaching for waitressing and life in the scorching Caribbean sun. I remember Bobby telling me about two cops he knew in missing persons and how they'd gone looking for an English teacher from Queens, happy family man with a new car and a nice lawn, who just went missing one day. 2 years later, they found him in Australia, teaching English. He had a nice lawn and a new car and a wife named Shelley, which had been the name of the wife he'd had before. It had seemed just a funny story then, but now I knew it was the essential truth about human nature. We'd traveled across the country, Robert and I, and in some way wound up where we'd been before. I looked at Robin Pearson, who was the secretary of the PTA, talking to Megan Dixon's mother, whose name I couldn't ever remember. They might as well have been Marie and Terry. The thing you took into a new life with you was yourself, and so you made it so much like it had been before, used and, yes, even comfortable. When I looked across at Cindy, pulling silver wrapping from a big box, I felt a spasm of pain and grief for Grace.
"Oh, look,"
Cindy said, unfolding a crib quilt, a pattern of hearts done in cross-stitch. She rummaged through the tissue for a card, and finally Mrs. Manford, in a tight, light voice, said,
"That one's from me, honey."
It made me remember Anne Benedetto then, too. Remember how she had once proposed a toast at Christmas to her boys. How she would give Bobby a cashmere sweater and a pair of outdoor